Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 86, Buying Congress on the Cheap. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain name registration and management that's simple. For 10% off your new domain, go to twill.hover.com. Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. It's time for your weekly rundown of all things related to the internet and the law. And we've got some great folks here today to go over those issues with you. Joining us once again is Evan Brown. Evan, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me. I always get a little shaky, you know, being away from the show for too long. So thanks for having me.
I know, I do. I do too. Yeah, no DTs right now. We're back on the show. So
right on.
Getting our weekly fix. And it's so fun for Evan and I to be able to meet people from around the world and around the U.S. who are interested in the same areas of the law as we are. And today we have two great newcomers to the show, both of whom are law professors. So all of you get your thinking caps on. We have some smart people joining us today for a change. One is Jack Lerner up the road from me at USC, University of Southern California. Welcome, Jack. Hi, great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
And also over on the other side of the country from the University of North Dakota is Professor Eric E. Johnson. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Denise. How you doing? Good to be here.
Great to have you. It's such a thrill to be able to bring you guys on and help Evan and I do the show because, you know, Evan and I are both practicing lawyers. I'm sort of a recovering litigator these days. Evan's still actively doing it. So our lives consist of addressing problems on a client-by-client kind of basis, doing research and pinpointing in, trying to solve specific problems at a time. I love having professors on the show because you guys have to, by nature of your jobs, look at the big picture and have a broader source and depth of knowledge than we might have to have at any one time. So we really appreciate your sharing that with us. And one big issue that requires a broad source and depth of knowledge these days is the net neutrality issue. So I wanted to lead off with that one if we can, especially in the wake of the recent election. Jack, I understand you have a role in California's election process. Could you elaborate on that for us?
I don't have a role in the election process. I'm on the board of a great organization called California Voter Foundation, which is a nonpartisan organization helping people mediate the intersection between technology and elections. And so they do a lot of reporting during the election. The head of the organization created a great proposition song that explained all the propositions in a funny way. So you should Google proposition song and you can probably find it on YouTube. And they do a lot of other stuff, including helping the state get a voter registration database up and running. And they were actually commissioned by the Secretary of State a few years ago to audit the reliability and security of electronic voting machines in the state. And they found all kinds of security problems and verifiability problems with electronic voting machines, which were fixed thanks to their work and other work. So this is really exciting for me to be part of CVF. And I've only been on affiliated with them for a few months, but it's a great organization. And the website is calvoter.org. So anyone who's thinking about elections in California, or specifically the role of technology in elections, should know that that's a great resource.
Well, thank you so much for that.
Sure.
The folks who supported net neutrality did not fare well in the recent elections across the United States. And I wonder if you could elaborate for us. I've seen you tweeting and pointing to a bunch of articles on this about how the lobbying efforts and funding of politicians has had an effect on that result.
Well, I should have brought the numbers with me to this show, because the amounts that were given by the telecommunications industry to candidates is just staggering. I mean, we're talking tens and tens of millions of dollars per quarter. I think AT&T, I mean, we're talking something like $20 or $30 million a year, or even a quarter. I can't say exactly how much. So that, you know, and that's a real problem because they're opponents of net neutrality, right? And net neutrality is basically the concept that that internet service should be treated like common carriers, like phone service. In other words, you know, the phone company doesn't charge me. They might charge me for distance. They might charge me for rates, but they don't charge me based on who I call, right? They don't say, okay, well, you can call the following 150 people and nobody else, right? Well, that's how cable works, you know, cable television. You know, they give you certain channels and that's what you get. The internet, you know, net neutrality argument, proponents say, hey, it should be the same concept, right? You should have, should be able to contact whoever you want, go to whatever site you want. So what you're talking about net, so that's the base concept of net neutrality. What you were talking about with respect to how net neutrality proponents fared in the election, what happened was something like 95 federal candidates signed a net neutrality pledge, and it turns out they all lost. So now, given that net neutrality wasn't a big issue in the election in any particular campaign that I know of, it means a couple of things. Number one, two thirds to three fourths of the money that was spent in this election was particularly outside money was anonymous, right? So it could be that the telecommunications industry just went after these particular candidates with a vengeance. It certainly means that, you know, big people like me who are really important who think that net neutrality is really important are not necessarily I don't have as much money as AT&T to give to candidates, obviously. So you have an imbalance. You know, you have consumer advocates some tech companies, but you don't have the same kind of moneyed interests on the same side of things. And what you see is a great imbalance there. So, you know, a lot of opponents of net neutrality were really excited about this result. They say, all these people lost. You see what this means? I see it the other way. I say that means probably that money in politics is having an effect, and that people who care about net neutrality aren't the rich ones and don't have, and that's one of the reasons why net neutrality is important, is because if you don't have a lot of money, you can still rely on the internet to get your message out or to allow people to get to you. Okay, so along with Michael Donaldson, who's a entertainment attorney here in Beverly Hills, my students and I wrote a comment that we filed with the FCC this spring on behalf of a coalition of major organizations of documentary and independent filmmakers. And what we said was, hey, listen, you've always had barriers to entry for documentary and independent filmmakers, right? You had the festival circuit, you had broadcast, you had theatrical distribution, and you had DVD. And all of those cost money and are difficult to do. Broadcast, obviously, there's not that many channels for over-the-air or cable broadcast. So you know, there were these huge barriers to entry. With the internet, those started coming down, but not before media industry consolidation raised those barriers to entry. And so independent television producers and independent distribution channels have been greatly constricted between about 1990 and now because of deregulation which led to consolidation, right? So our argument was, hey, the internet has once again lowered these, or not even once again, is lowered these barriers to entry. And that's a really, really amazing, wonderful thing. And it's a thing that's going to revolutionize filmmaking as well as lots of other things. The problem is, if you have net neutrality, you know, what you're going to see is there net neutrality. If you don't have net neutrality, what you're going to have is a fast lane for well-capitalized companies that can pay for it. And that aren't critical and aren't fighting with the ISPs, which is a key but, right? Everybody else is going to be relegated to the slow lane. Now, if you're sending an email, you know, 1 megabyte file, that may not matter very much. But if you want to stream video from your little website, your little independent filmmaker, and you have 10,000 people that want to see your video or your film, that's a problem, because now they may not be able to see that, or if they do, it may be a problem. And so what we're saying is that there should be a level playing field. It's really a question of, do you treat the internet like the telephone or do you treat it like cable television? And I think that the answer should be obvious to anybody who's thinking about this that doesn't have a direct stake in a lack of net neutrality. Right. And I'll add one other thing, which is that in many, many other countries, and the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School did an amazing study on this, where internet providers are treated like phone companies and said, okay, look, you're allowed to charge for access to the pipes, but you have to give the same access to everyone, and you have to allow other companies to rent from you at a reasonable price the pipes. In most other countries, that's how they do it, and they call that an open access policy, and that's, you know, I think it's fairly clear that that's a major reason we don't have that now. And that's a major reason why we lag behind most other countries. We're in the 20s in most rankings of broadband access and what kind of broadband access we have. Now, part of that is because we're a much bigger country than, for example, Finland or South Korea. And those other countries also have a lot of government investment. But a big reason is because if you don't have net neutrality, then if we don't have net neutrality, then ISPs are actually incentivized to restrict bandwidth, raise demand, which raises prices. Okay, so they're actually incentivized not to invest as opposed to incentivized to invest. Makes
right.
sense?
Right, Yeah, it does make sense. And I think it's safe to say as we watch the telecommunications entertainment industry evolve before our very eyes, that the reason we have cable, the reason we have satellite services today is due to a scarcity of distribution methods, right? The cable companies laid the pipes and got a distribution channel into people's homes. The satellite companies hung birds in the air and transmitted from them. With the internet as a ubiquitous means of transport of all kinds of data, some of that begins to go away, and hence you have a bunch of protectionism from the folks who are in the entrenched slots. And I'm wondering, and let's get Eric's take on this. I'm wondering, Eric, how you see the interplay of all this with, for example, the Fox Cable Vision dispute that we saw during the World Series, and also with the network channels blocking Google TV from being able to access them from their device when inexplicably, if you use any other browser, you can access that material just fine. How does all that play in with net neutrality, and where do we go from here?
Yeah, well, I think what you pointed out are a few examples of why this is not a merely a theoretical matter. It's extremely important, and the telecommunication companies would not care about tiered service, which is what they see as the alternative to network neutrality, network non-neutrality. That's why they care so much about it, because they are ready to use it. And what you're referring to, the Fox Cablevision dispute, other things, they're ready to use these, and they want to. It means a lot more money for them, and where there's a lot of money on the line, there's going to be a lot of pressure on politicians to see things the corporation's way. You know, Jack pointed out how many millions of dollars are given to Congress in these lobbying efforts, and I have some numbers here from the Center for Responsive Politics, opensecrets.org, and this may not capture everything, but it says over the past 20 years, AT&T has given $45.66 million. Now, one way to think about that is that that's an enormous amount of money. But another way to think about it is that's really not very much money at all. If you cut that by 20 years, that's about $2.3 million a year. And $2.3 million a year to buy Congress is pretty cheap. I mean, a Super Bowl commercial in 2010, a 30-second spot on the Super Bowl was $2.6 million. So if you can buy Congress, if you can buy Capitol Hill for less than the cost of a Super Bowl commercial, you know, sometimes I think it's to me, what's astonishing about lobbying and is not that Congress has a price, because we all have a price, but just that it's so cheap. You know, when you split that up amongst a bunch of different politicians, I mean, that's so it's while it's a lot of money to me or you, it's not a lot of money for AT&T or Comcast or these big companies in terms of what they can get on the back end from having tiered service. And it's incredibly important. Jack analogized this to telephone versus cable service, which is a very good analogy. I might add to that to think about it as the road right now. If you drive down the freeway and you have the choice of patronizing Walmart or some small business, the freeway is going to move just as fast for you no matter who you are. But how it would work with tiered service if we have network neutrality is that your car would go faster to Walmart. I mean, it would drive five times faster to Walmart than to the little locally owned store. And put videos to one side, even things like blogs, when you're downloading a blog and it takes a little while on your handheld device versus the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal comes down instantly, that's going to make a difference to people's decisions. And it really will be a shame because the internet has the potential to be the great leveler that democratizes media and entertainment, allows everybody to get involved, to make movies, to write their own stories, to be heard, and for all those creative voices to be heard. And this is going to take a big chunk out of it if it goes down that way. And it's going to be sad, you know. And we'll see who wins. That's completely up in the air. And it may be someday that we all have a non-neutral internet and we don't think much about it, but we'll have lost out on a lot.
And I just want to add to what Eric was saying. I actually checked out opensecrets.org, and thanks for that link, Eric. AT&T gave $12.5 million just this year, and this year's not over yet. And since 1998, has actually given $158 million in lobbying, or spent $158 million. So that doesn't include ads. That doesn't include secret donations to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, or not secret, but, you know, undisclosed. So just wanted to add that we're talking $12.5 million this year on reported lobbying and $158 million on lobbying alone since 1998. And that's just AT&T. Verizon is at $13 million for this year. And for all years, Verizon's at $145 million. So a lot of money.
What's it going to take to combat this, guys? You know, I mean, it seems we're all talking about this as though it's a done deal and we're watching net neutrality slide away slowly and inevitably. Is there any way of stopping this slide? Evan, do you see any hope on the horizon here?
I don't have enough insight to recognize how something like that on a magnificent scale could occur. Maybe I'm just unreasonably accepting what some would characterize as a dim future in trying to characterize it in a way that maybe it's not all that dim. I just remember a couple months or so ago back, there was, what was it, some kind of informal set of principles that Google and Verizon had entered into. Yeah. And one of the things that was kind of absent from its absent or conspicuous in its absence was this whole notion of alternative, I forget the exact terminology that they use, but alternative ways of using the internet that would be kind of outside of the ordinary internet, the way we think of it now, different types of essentially creating an end run around network neutrality. And there would be these specialized services. And I never saw anything really compelling that said inherently why those alternative services might be bad. It seems like if there are different flavors, different channels, different ways for content and bits of data to be transmitted from one point to the other over the internet, some of these having being the subject of premium services, there very well could be some good things come out of that framework in terms of the public interest. So to answer your question, I have no idea about what might combat this on a large and magnificent scale. I'm just trying to be not entirely pessimistic as to what the world may look like if we don't have network neutrality, and wonder try to wonder seriously whether it would really be all that bad.
Well, what do you think, Eric? Does this go to your road analogy, going quickly to Walmart but not anywhere else, and thus everywhere else kind of falls off the map?
I think in some ways, I think that in some ways, if it comes to pass, we won't think of it as being that bad because we won't know what we're missing. And it also depends on some technical things that are hard to wrap your mind around. I mean, in part, it depends on what the overall speed and bandwidth that's available is. Generally, I think that it's pretty regrettable if that happens. And I'm sure those you can always think, well, maybe there'll be some really good things that we'll enjoy getting. But as Jack pointed out, there's already not a lot of incentive to build more capacity into the system, and one of the problems with net neutrality, the lack of net neutrality, is that it doesn't seem to incentivize telecom companies to build more capacity. So if it's a policy that does not incentivize them to build more capacity, clearly that's bad. And if it favors some content producers over other content producers, then at least as far as I'm concerned, that's bad. And I guess some people could differ. But, you can make that argument that the carrot of additional money will make things better. And while that's generally true in a free market economy, when you're dealing with the not entirely free market for telecommunication services and bandwidth, I'm not sure that it applies.
Let me frame a more specific question along these lines. We've been talking in sort of general terms about net neutrality and its impacts, but let's hone in on this issue of Google TV getting blocked. Now, this is the kind of thing that if a client were to stroll in and want to consult with me, would smack me as potentially actionable. I can't really put my finger on why it would be, but I would certainly want to sit down and give it some thought. Jack, going to you first, do you think that there is any sort of legal recourse that Google can or should pursue for the major network channels saying we are going to allow every other browser but yours to be able to bring this content in?
Well, the only thing I'd say is it sounds awfully anti-competitive to me. So mm-hmm. If I were Google, I'd be calling up my outside counsel that has an expertise in antitrust and saying this looks like really anti-competitive behavior to us, and we have a problem with that. I don't know the specifics of it. The Federal Trade Commission also has jurisdiction over unfair trade practices, and that could qualify. And the FCC obviously can get involved and has some expertise there too. But I'm not familiar enough with the facts to give you a great capsule of what I think. What I think the legal issues are in terms of what Google's recourse might be. But I think the bigger issue is opponents of net neutrality say, where's the harm? Where's the harm? There hasn't been, you've seen a couple of little incidents here and there. One is that people are laying the groundwork. So Verizon, Comcast, and large entertainment companies to a lesser degree are saying, okay, we're getting ready to do this, and what we want to do is discriminate in various ways and have managed, what they call managed services, which is not clear what that means in the rulemaking that the FCC is doing right now. But I think what it probably means, managed services, means a dedicated fast lane. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a really good example, and I believe Eric pointed this out before, of an example, or maybe it was you, Denise. This is a problem that this is evidence of the kind of thing that is going to happen more and more unless we have net neutrality rules that are easy to understand, clear, and enforced.
And Eric, you teach antitrust at your school. Do you see any actionability there?
Yeah, ask Eric.
You know, the antitrust laws, what's wonderful and frightening about them is how incredibly vague they are. So it really comes down to whether or not you can make a good economic argument for what you're doing. And the recent trend with our Supreme Court now is to be very accepting of what courts in past decades would have regarded as illegal restraints on trade. So the trend is toward looser antitrust laws that are not as heavy-handed, and antitrust cases take a very long time to litigate. So that's just a way of, I guess, dodging your question, which is to say I don't know. But antitrust laws are very much like constitutional law or the common law of torts or contracts, in that they develop in response to changing opinions and changing culture and changing economic times. And when you have, you know, I hate to be too much of a what you call a legal realist, but when you have a judge who thinks about these issues carefully, in a case like that that offends your moral sensibilities, there's always a chance that the court will come down on the side that seems to be more fair. And to get back to one other question you asked in terms of what can be done to fight back, to fight for net neutrality. The FCC, the commissioners we have now, they're in favor of net neutrality. A lot of people who've thought about this issue are in favor of net neutrality. I would imagine that most people who are interested in these issues favor net neutrality. So it may come down to whether it's a judge or FCC commissioners which are going to decide these issues, which my guess would be that they would be much more likely to side on the net neutrality side of things, or whether it's going to be Congress. And, you know, as Jack's pointed out, a lot of money has been paid for Congress, and especially where it's an issue that is not right at the top of voters' minds, then it's certainly an issue where money can sway votes in Congress. There's no doubt.
Yeah, and you know, here, I mean, listen, Meg Whitman spent more than any one candidate has ever spent in our history on her election, and she lost by 12 points. I mean, she outspent Jerry Brown by something like 10 to 1.
I saw a great tweet on that. Somebody said, I was happy to see that Meg Whitman couldn't just click buy it now on the election.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I saw some great analysis actually by a Republican on this who said, who said she spent so much money that became part of the story, and that that's what people knew about her much more than her message. And she didn't really have a theme other than she was willing to spend whatever it took. But another example is Pacific Gas and Electric has had to fight off several propositions in the Bay Area to try to turn management of electrical power over to the city and to have municipal power the way that we do here in L.A. Mm-hmm. And PG&E has narrowly fought off these challenges. So in the spring, PG&E put a ballot on the statewide ballot that said it would make it extremely difficult for any municipality to move over from private power to municipal power. And they spent $45 million of ratepayer money to do this, and they lost. And the other side, which is a couple of nonprofit consumer groups, spent $100,000. The voters just saw through it. And I think they saw through Meg Whitman as well, or at least they didn't buy what she was selling.
Right.
So, you know, there is hope that net neutrality, and I think net neutrality is a real no-brainer once you start talking about it, as Eric just said. But I think that that it's a little bit confusing. It's very technical. People don't understand the stakes. But I think it's one of the most important issues to our democracy.
Yeah, and I hope, you know, some politicians are out there talking about it. We had our 90-something who had at least signed on in support of it, and hopefully they will keep up the good work, even though they didn't manage to retain or win their seats. Al Franken is out there, of course. He has been an ardent supporter of net neutrality, and hopefully others will continue to carry the flag. And I appreciate your wrapping that up on a hopeful note for us there, Jack, because it's kind of a depressing topic. And I wanted to transition to something that's also hopeful, and that is Professor Edward Felton coming on and in the newly created role of chief technologist for the FTC. Do you guys know Ed Felton, and are you familiar with his work, Jack?
I don't know him personally. I have worked with some of the people in his research center at Princeton, and he has been just an incredible voice for individual innovation. He has a blog called Freedom to Tinker, which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And there's a great article out there if you Google something like five outlandish or
outrageous. It's in our discussion
hacks
point.
Five outrageous hacks by Ed Felton. You know, and it's really interesting because on the one hand, some of the stuff he's done has been hostile to, for example, the entertainment industry. He showed that you know, the digital rights management technology that Sony put on its CDs actually used hacker tools that left your PC very vulnerable to being cracked, being hacked itself. And he's done some other stuff involving DRM, which is, you know, essentially the encryption that are on DVDs and CDs and things like iTunes Fair Play. But, you know, then he did a study, and I actually found out about this from somebody in the MPAA. He did a study of the files on peer-to-peer networks and showed that when it comes to movies, 100%, as he found it, of the movies were actually infringing. So he's not, I don't think he's a partisan or someone who's an ideologue in favor of one industry or another. But I think that he's had an incredible leadership role or an incredibly powerful voice, rather, in standing up in favor of individual innovation and the ability to do what you will with your computer or your iPad or your phone or whatever it is. And so he's just had an incredible presence on the tech policy stage from this very, very, very competent, incredibly competent and just professional scientific computer science perspective. And so to have him at the FTC is a huge coup for the FTC to get him. It's just great. To the extent a government agency can have a coup of that sort. But
yeah, I loved Boing Boing's post on this where they called him Princeton professor and RIAA Tantra extraordinaire. Your DRM smells of elderberries. Ha! Huh. And there, Evan, is your Monty Python reference for the show, just in case.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Eric, any thoughts on Ed Felton and his coming tenure as chief technologist at the FTC?
Well, I think it's great. I think the FTC does a lot of things. They are a group of people in government who are very, very motivated to do a great job on behalf of the people in the United States. You can see it throughout their work. They seem to be people who get up in the morning to go use their positions on behalf of consumers and seem to have a lot more mojo than a lot of other government agencies. And you know, a big part of good governing is having the right advice, having the right information inputs. And I think it's fantastic on their part. And he'll, I'm sure, give them a tremendous amount of good information and take the cover off what is very, very confusing and difficult to understand for an agency that is trying to pursue ancient concepts of fairness in a rapidly changing arena. So kudos to them.
Mm-hmm. And I just, this really doesn't have anything much to do with how effectively he will do his job. But it's really encouraging to me to have somebody who's just like such a long time, not just mover and shaker in this area of poking around the fringes of what's appropriate for individuals in the realm of technology law, but that he's written so publicly and transparently about it. He's been a blogger forever. He tweets as himself at Ed Felton. I love it when people in government positions are actual human beings that you can, you know, have some transparent knowledge of. And he's definitely that kind of person.
He's tweeting, though.
his November 4th tweet just reads, "I will be chief technologist at the Federal Trade Commission," period. A couple of links. But no, he's continuing on after that. So yeah, you're right. Who knows how much one is able to do along those lines based on the strictures of one's office. But, you know, we can only hope. And I think it would be hard to rein someone like him in. What do you think, Evan?
That's for sure. I mean, my general impression on all of this, it's almost as cool as if Sanjay Gupta had been made Surgeon General. but maybe even better. Because, you know, he brings in such a wonderful background of experience, both, you know, a very extremely talented technologist, and also, you know, having used his resources with, you know, computer science students at Princeton to actually do a lot of this stuff. But it seems to be a really rare mix to see in one person, the ability to take that technological acumen and have such a keen sense of policy issues, and the way that the knowledge gained from that, you know, that wonderfully detailed technical expertise can be made to really affect larger policy questions. So that's, you know, the remarkable thing I see about him. And given that that alchemy, you know, that's going on with him here, it would be hard to keep him down. He's not going to be the type of person to be a bureaucrat or to, you know, to play the role of the typical bureaucrat. And if anybody can have effective leadership in that role, it would be someone like him. So really,
yeah,
a cool
and
thing.
One of the criticisms of the FTC that I had heard recently, in recent months or years, was that they really had no scientists there. They did not have, you know, a technology office, to my knowledge, and they didn't have really just simply technologists there. So to have him there and help them figure out things like, for example, the Wall Street Journal's recent series on privacy and on how it was on who's sort of how third-party marketing companies were interacting with Facebook and lots of other sites that you visit, and how your information about what your browsing habits was being passed around. And that's a very, very technically difficult thing to understand. And the Wall Street Journal did an amazing job of explaining it, and they had this graphic that they developed, this interactive graphic that was really special. So if somebody on the Twitter chat on the IRC chat wants to find it and link to it, that'd be great. Or I'll do it after this. But the point is, the FTC needs to understand this technology too. And if there's anybody in the country who can break it down for them and figure it out and help them understand it and then help them make decisions about it, it would be Ed, you know. And so it's a really exciting development. Because now they're going to be able to deal with all these technology issues that they really didn't have the capacity to deal with in-house before. And so they do things like have roundtables and have folks explain it to them in panels and hearings and things like that.
Yep. I love it. It's good news. We were talking there for a minute about what one can and cannot blog based on the strictures of one's employer. We're going to get to a discussion of that in more detail, as well as our gratuitous porn link for the show. But before we get to that, I would really love to thank our sponsor, Hover.com. This show is brought to you by Hover.com, and I can't tell you how happy I am to have Hover as a sponsor, because I'm an avid user of the service and can tell you that it is just a wonderful way, not just to manage your domains, but to manage your online identity. Hover, of course, is about making domain registration and service simple, but it's more than that. Once you have simple, full-featured domain management, you can start to do things like have a short URL associated with your name that doesn't require a whole lot of headache on your part. You know, all of us are way too busy to be worrying about our domain management and maintaining our mail servers or whatever, but we still want to have a personalized, easily accessible online identity and life. And Hover makes it really easy for you to do that. They will help you. They will walk you through transferring in your domains. They have a special offer going right now that when you transfer in a domain from another service, the transfers are free and they'll charge you just $10 to extend the domain registration for 1 year past its current expiration date. And if you have any trouble transferring it in, of course, other sites don't make it that easy to do. Hover has this amazing customer service where it's a no-hold policy. As long as you're calling between 9 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern, you get a live person on the line first thing. No recording, no nothing else. They'll walk you right through whatever problems you're having. And then they'll send you a personalized support ticket with the name of the person you talk to. So if you need to do any follow-up, you can just respond to their email and let them know that something's still not resolved or what have you. And they work with you until it's resolved. This morning, right before the show, I have a domain that I manage with Hover, and the forwarding wasn't working right. And that's such an important thing, I think, in today's web, where we're all using hosting services such as our other sponsor, Squarespace, where if you don't maintain a domain name, you're using a generic kind of address for your blog and or whatever website you have. And you don't want to do that. You want to have bagandbaggage.com, for example, like mine. But if there's some kind of problem with it, again, we're all too busy to really understand the way DNS works and propagates. I had forgotten to tweak the name servers, and so my forwarding wasn't working right. I had someone from Hover. It was, let's see, here's his email to me, Bob Shee. He fixed me up in about 5 minutes and figured out exactly what was going on. And now my imetdenise.com domain is resolving to where I wanted it to go, which is about.me/Denise Howell. That tells you everything you need to know about stuff that I'm doing online. And that was so easy to resolve thanks to Hover's great customer service. You can set up email addresses there. You can get personalized email addresses there. You can forward your email anywhere. So if you're an avid Gmail user, don't worry. You don't have to give up your service. It all works together seamlessly. It'll redirect you to other domains and website addresses, create URL extensions, set privacy controls. And by the way, if you're used to paying for Whois privacy at your other domain management services, you won't pay for it at Hover. It's free. So do go over to hover.com and check out their great, clean, user-friendly interface and all their wonderful services. We thank them so much for sponsoring the show. When you do register a domain or use other services there, go to twill.hover.com and use the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L, and you'll get 10% off. So thanks so much, Hover. Love using you and hope our users do too. So let's get into face porn, since I dangled that out there before the break. There's a great Violet Blue post over at ZDNet. I just love Violet Blue's writing, and she has her own unique take on Facebook's trademark lawsuit against face porn, which they don't much care for. It's an adult services sort of Facebook analogy. It's a social network for adult kind of conversations, I guess I would have to say. And but Facebook doesn't like that they're calling themselves face porn. They didn't like a few months ago that someone was calling themselves teach book. So we see something else transpiring along these lines. Eric, any thoughts on this? Is face porn doomed to change its name with Facebook coming after them in this way?
Oh, you know, it probably is, but not for sound legal reasons. And I think this was in Violet Blue's post, but it says in Facebook's court ruling, the company stated that face porn, quote, blatantly copied the Facebook logo site in Walmart, close quote. The thing about trademark law is there's no problem with copying. Trademark is not copyright. The trademark has never made it illegal to copy someone's logo or look or name. What trademark protects is an identity against the likelihood of confusion. That's the standard for trademark infringement, that a consumer is likely to be confused by someone's use of a logo into thinking that the commercial source of that service or product is someone else. And how anyone could think that Facebook is behind Faceborn is, seems unlikely. So it shows you kind of where we've moved in terms of thinking about intellectual property for people to complain, well, you copied my trademark, and to put that in a filing to a court. And I haven't read the entire complaint, so I don't know how indicative that is. And I'm sure that their lawyers understand more about trademark than is encapsulated in that quote. But this is what I call the playground theory of intellectual property. Stop copying me. Stop copying me. Stop copying me. That's not what intellectual property is really about. It's a very specific set of legal rights for certain things. And copying someone's logo is just not an actionable harm. You have to show a likelihood of confusion. Why FacePorn will probably have to change their name is when you get a huge multi-billion-dollar entity coming at you with all of their lawyers and their massive litigation war chest, they'll wear you down. And FacePorn is not necessarily the most sympathetic defendant out there, but there are many small businesses who've been bullied by thugs like Facebook, Apple, with their coming after people with Pod in their name, or my alma mater, the University of Texas at Austin, likes to come after every dry cleaner or little store that has anything resembling a UT trademark. So it's unfortunate, but that's the kind of arguments that are made these days. And if you read a lot of appellate opinions, unfortunately, they stick sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Jack, any thoughts on FacePorn and their ability to continue on in this vein?
Well, you know, unfortunately, the law, you know, there is not the same. There are fair use exceptions in trademark law, but they're not exactly the same as fair use exceptions in copyright law. And as a result, instead people say, I have a First Amendment defense to use this or something like that. So I totally agree with Eric that the question of likelihood of confusion is difficult. There's also the argument that they'd be diluting the Facebook name or tarnishing, which is a form of dilution, the Facebook name. So it's unfortunately, it's not a slam dunk case, or fortunately, if you hate FacePorn, but unfortunately for FacePorn, I just kind of enjoy saying that word. Is that bad?
I'm sure that's why they're using it.
It's not a slam dunk case for them, unfortunately. So the law isn't as clear, and there's so much, because everybody who does business essentially has a trademark. There's just so much trademark litigation out there, and that means there's a lot more reported cases, and the cases are more diverse, arguably, than copyright. And the law has gotten is a little bit more complex on how you can use something in certain ways. So, for example, if there was a FacebookSucks.com, Facebook mm-hmm. That would be a slam dunk case. I think that FacePorn.com is a closer case. Again, unfortunately for FacePorn, because I think that the dilution and tarnishment argument, and tarnishment is a legal term of art, especially because it's used
making you look bad. Is that?
Yeah, but it's specifically used to, if it's specifically invoked when you're talking about sex or drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, so playing with trademarks and calling them and using drug or sexual references or lascivious type of things, types of expressions that's what courts look for when they look for tarnishment. So we'll see how it plays out. I wouldn't be surprised if they went away. But you know, there are lots of other things you can do. I mean, there are YouTube knockoffs as well. Like one, mm-hmm. I think one is called Red Tube or Blue Tube or something like that.
You don't have to feign any unfamiliarity with it. It's all good. You're among friends.
Right. I've heard that there are sites like that. They're certainly out there. And if this one goes away, who's to say another one wouldn't pop up?
Oh, I'm just going to leave that alone. But just to clarify for a second, you said that Facebook Sucks might be more of a slam dunk, and that under the fair use analogy, because that's commentary, criticism, right?
Right. And in trademark law, fair use has a different meaning than in copyright law. And that might be considered a First Amendment argument as opposed to a fair use argument. But now we're getting into the weeds on trademark law in ways that aren't that helpful. But, you know, I don't think it's as much of a slam dunk as something that's clearly directly critical of Facebook. And that's the difference.
Right. Well, as long as we're on Facebook, let's just chat for a moment about the fact that Facebook is having to come down on a number of its developers when the Wall Street Journal profiled the fact that its top 10 most popular developer applications, third-party applications running on Facebook, were transmitting user IDs to, I guess, fourth parties. There are a number of these sites that are getting slapped on the wrist by Facebook, who says that they absolutely do not condone that kind of behavior by an application. And Zynga, who is the publisher of Farmville, one of the offenders in there. So I guess it's not too outrageous or, I guess, eyebrow-raising to know that this is happening. But again, just one of the dangers of having your data in a system where there are leak points at any number of outlets. Evan, any thoughts on the data leak and any ramifications that might happen to the developers or the users of Facebook?
I don't think it's really, it shouldn't be a surprise to any of us that this has happened. It's just one of those natural nefarious things that can happen on an open platform like Facebook. And Facebook really has no choice but to react swiftly and unequivocally in the way that it has, reiterating that it has a zero tolerance policy for this kind of stuff, you know, developers taking data that they have promised to keep secret and giving it, or, you know, selling it to information brokers. So the silver lining of all of this could be that Facebook has the opportunity now to really do something that states in no uncertain terms its concern for privacy. This is much more of a powerful message, or there's an opportunity for it to send much more powerful of a message than to just merely make promises that it respects user privacy and all this stuff. If it's going to keep these developers off of the platform for at least 6 months, like it says that it will, that's, you know, a definite clear message that it's sending, and it could raise its reputation in terms of safeguarding privacy. So that's a kind of a positive side effect that could come about from all of this scandal here.
Right. Just wanted to point out along these lines that over on the Project VRM list, Joe Andrew, if I'm saying his French last name correctly, has come up with a great application, a great site called iSharedWhat.com that shows you exactly what you are sharing with third-party applications on Facebook. So for an eye-opener along those lines, potentially go check out that new utility. Eric, any thoughts on information leaking from Facebook?
Well, if what Evan said is right, that it's going to enhance their reputation for looking out for users' privacy, that's probably true. It's pretty cheap for them to do that because they don't have anything on the line. I mean, in a sense, Facebook could be indignant about this just because someone else was making money off of users' data rather than them. So it's an easy call for them to make. I don't know. Facebook only seems to care about privacy because Facebook users staged a revolt. And so I don't know that that really means that they care about privacy at some deep level. But it's good that Facebook users and internet users in general care enough about privacy to provide some sort of pressure on providers that they're at least taking some of these actions. I don't know, not really a surprise, and not really a surprise that Facebook would act all tough about this. I mean, when we'll really know about their new dedication to privacy is when they face the temptation to make some money for themselves out of users' data and what kind of choice they make at that time.
Well, I can't think of a better segue over to Jack and his upcoming panel at South by Southwest and the article and work he's done on coming up with a social network user's bill of rights. Can you tell us about that, Jack?
Yeah, Lisa Brodkin and I wrote an op-ed that was published in the San Francisco Chronicle earlier this year I think it was in April. And what we essentially said was, look, Facebook and Google in particular, but other social networking companies as well, are engaging in all kinds of behaviors that aren't good for users and that don't have users' best interests in mind, right? So one of them is what we were really upset about at that time was, in a way, even more straightforward and less nefarious, and certainly even more, in a way, more transparent than what the Wall Street Journal is reporting on, and we're talking about here, which is, what we were upset about was changing privacy policy terms without really getting users' consent before doing so, and then they made it hard to some of the things you couldn't opt out of. Lots of our viewers, I'm sure, will remember this, and Facebook was being disingenuous about what it was doing. Facebook was making it difficult to opt out of. The settings were very, very complex. So there were several other people that called for a bill of rights for users. The Electronic Frontier Foundation did. A writer at PC World wrote about that as well. And there were lots of similarities. Okay, so one was be honest, right? Be transparent. Which aren't quite the same thing. Be honest. In other words, tell us what you're doing and be straight about it. Transparent is tell us what you're doing and also tell us when there's a glitch or when there's a leak or when there's a problem that's been identified and what you're doing to fix it. And Facebook's been okay about that. They really haven't been very good, and it's been more about the press. And I would like to see a feed of some kind that Facebook maintains that says there was a problem here and here's what we did about it. Other things we asked for were the ability to port your data, to be able to say, all right, I want to take all my data off of Facebook. I want to download it onto my hard drive and then upload it to another social networking site if I don't like what you're doing, right? And one of the problems was that, when I went onto Facebook, it was all unique. It was all within a closed group, right? And nothing was made public unless I wanted that to be the case. Actually, even before they started defaulting a lot of stuff to public, I changed my location from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Now, when I headed to San Francisco, it said I lived in San Francisco, but I didn't tell. No one in San Francisco who wasn't a friend of mine could see any of my data. And that was the same for the networks I was in. When I moved to Los Angeles, it magically defaulted to everyone in Los Angeles being able to see all of my data because they were in my group. So it was, shenanigans like that that we were objecting to. Facebook has now allows you to download your material, and now Google and Facebook are in a fight because Google wants to be able to read. Because Facebook has an importer where you can log into Gmail and you can get all your Gmail contacts and find them on Facebook. But Facebook doesn't allow Gmail to do that. And so Google said, all right, well, from now on, we're not going to let you do that either. And so, they're having this big fight, and it may lead to more user portability, but it also it kind of hurts users in the meantime. And, all the things at Facebook, I just want to point out. Does everybody know about what happened originally with Google Buzz? Because
yes.
I think
it's safe to say that the folks listening live probably do. For anyone who does not, that there was an effort by Google to make Buzz quickly more useful for people by importing their Gmail contacts immediately into their, I don't know what you would call Buzz. It was sort of a social networking Twitter kind of experience where you could put brief messages out there and
I love
have
how you're talking about it past tense, Denise.
Well, it's done. Still around. I mean, they have discontinued. well, actually, no, I'm getting that confused. With weight, it definitely had a privacy snafu at the beginning, where all of a sudden the context was switched for users from email to Buzz with the same universe of email contacts, and that turned out to be not appropriate. And in fact, they just settled, as we've talked about on the show in the last one or two episodes, a class action lawsuit about that. So.
I was instant messaging people I know at Google, like, what are you doing? I can't believe you did this, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because at one point last year, I believe it was last year, with the flick of the switch, Facebook made millions and millions of photos public that had, because they defaulted to public and they had mm-hmm. been restricted to people's networks or restricted to people's friends beforehand. And I'm not sure exactly, I can't track down the exact date on which that occurred. But I think that was as a great or even possibly greater of a violation than what Google did. You know, Facebook, to its credit, responded, and Mark Zuckerberg talked about this in some interviews and stuff. They went to the mattresses, so to speak, trying mm-hmm. to come up with a better system, and you have to give them credit. I didn't agree with everything they did, but they did come to the mattresses. So back to the social networking users' Bill of Rights. So several people asked for some rights just like that, and then the Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference dedicated their whole conference, which is a group of, you know, people dedicated to computers, freedom, and privacy. They dedicated the whole conference to this concept, and they came up with a much more expanded Bill of Rights that was endorsed by the conference. And then they're going to keep voting open until June of next year, of 2011. And hopefully we're going to have line item votes on each right in the Bill of Rights. And you know, some of the things that Lisa and I did not call for are in there, and I'm still thinking about those. And one is the right to have an anonymous profile or a pseudonymous profile. Mm-hmm.
Thinking about, first of all, tell us where, if it is out there in a publicly available and commentable form.
I think it's at CFP.org. And then from there, you can look at, if you go to CFP2010.org, you can find links to it, I believe. Yeah. So,
you're going to be leading a session on this at South by Southwest.
That's right.
Can you tell us, I did a post last week thinking about, and we talked about it a bit on the show, location services and the inevitable legal hurdles and challenges they will face as they manage and potentially mismanage their user data. Mm-hmm. Are you factoring them into the mix when you're thinking of these rights issues for users?
Well,
things
to
like Foursquare.
I think absolutely, because Foursquare is a social networking site. This isn't just about Facebook or mm-hmm. Google Buzz or whatever iteration, you know, Google's next social networking service is. It's a combination. It's, you know, it's any social networking service. And so, you know, the privacy issues are very complicated. A lot, you know, Twitter, for example, has been a pretty good actor. They had some leaks due to some sloppy security arrangements, but in terms of their deliberate policies, they've been pretty respectful of users' privacy and have not, for example, been defaulting people into public types of settings that they hadn't affirmatively opted into. But location services are certainly an issue, and you know, companies need to think carefully about how they handle that, and especially when they're talking about dealing with third-party marketing companies. And there, as we know from the Wall Street Journal and other sources, there's a lot out there. There are a lot of those companies out there. So you know, I think respecting users' privacy preferences is very, very important. Safeguarding data, safeguarding location data. So if I have, you know, if I have my GPS turned on and I tell Google that my location, that they can look at my location in order to serve me up local search results or something, then that's my preference, and I'm thank Google for making that service available. But that also comes with, we've made a social contract as well, and Google has a social contract with its users as well, that it's going to safeguard that data, that it's going to not give that data over to the government just with a phone call, for example, that it's going to dispose of that data after a pretty short period of time. And unfortunately, I just don't trust Google to do that, to really take that burden on as if it's their own burden.
Denise, can I ask Jack a question?
Absolutely.
Jack, to what extent do you think that this needs to be law or legislated? Or to what extent could we have, you talked about a social contract, to what extent is it feasible that we could have sort of a collective bargaining type of solution here, where maybe there is an overarching legal scheme that protects users' rights to band together, like employees can to form a union, and to negotiate something like a bill of rights, a set of collectively bargained for rights on behalf of users. Is something like that something that could ever happen?
I think that's a really interesting question, Eric, and I'm really glad you brought that up. You know, the idea of a social networking user's bill of rights is in part, part of what we're trying to do is to say we don't necessarily have to go running to Congress to legislate these protections, particularly because technology moves so fast, the services that are being offered move so fast, and law just simply doesn't keep up very well. A collective bargaining solution, whether that was just a you could say the EFF or some other organization could get together and say, all right, we're going to certify these companies that respect this bill of rights, and users are gonna have that as a piece of information that they can rely on or not rely on. I mean, I think that would be a lovely solution if you know, and that could evolve over time, and so that certification or something like that could evolve over time. But you know, would that be enforceable if someone said, okay, well, we're going to abide by all of these things and we're going to get the certification? Would that be enforceable by law? Possibly. Depends, you know, and it might be enforceable by unfair competition laws as much as anything else. So I think that a private solution, part of what we're trying to do is to say users need to stand up for themselves and get together on a collective basis somehow. Now, of course, that's very difficult for consumers to do. And I won't get too wonky on you here. It's probably too late for that. But, recent studies have actually shown that it's actually economically rational for consumers not to, for example, change their passwords every week the way that they're urged to, you know, every month. People keep the same passwords because it's just not worth the effort to change. So, you know, you have to craft a solution that works for people who don't have a lot of technical sophistication, who don't have a lot of time. And maybe don't have all the information about what the risks are. And so it's an uphill challenge.
Yeah, that's why I'm wondering if labor law couldn't be some kind of a model there. Because one reason that employees can effectively collectively bargain with their employers is because of the enabling scheme of federal labor law, which provides certain procedural requirements and provides a structure whereby employees can actually get together and exert some power that they probably would not be able to do without that labor law context.
Eric, I think you and I just found our next paper. I'll see you at the IP Scholars Conference. We're going to have to.
And I think we all just found our next story to discuss because. And Eric, I'll have you lead off on addressing this first, since you write your blog law blog. The NRLB has actually sued a medical transportation company over its blogging policy, which it finds to be too restrictive of employee organizing kind of activities under its standards. Can you tell us about that and what this might mean for other blogging policies?
Yeah, this is very, very exciting. This is out of Connecticut. Don Marie Souza posted some negative comments about her employer, a private ambulance company called American Medical Response, on Facebook. And that ran afoul of that company's policy, which basically said something, I guess, like you can't post anything bad about us on the internet. So the National Labor Relations Board is getting involved. Why is the National Labor Relations Board getting involved? Well, that's the arm of the federal government that is involved with labor law. And the idea of labor law is that unions can provide rights for employees by coming up with a collective bargaining agreement. But even before you form a union, federal labor law protects your right to kvetch, basically, to your fellow employees. You have a federally protected right to moan and complain and bellyache to your colleagues at work, because it's that kind of activity that can lead to the formation of a union. So this is a very exciting weapon that employees may have here against very overbroad policies by companies that prohibit employees from saying things that are negative, or sometimes saying anything at all about their employers, and it's very exciting. We'll find out how this goes, but it's the NLRB, I think, is right on. There's no doubt that blogging or posting to a social network about troubles at work and how rotten and stupid and crazy your supervisor is the kind of protected, concerted activity that the National Labor Relations Act is thinking about in terms of needing to put a shield around so that employees can get together and collectively bargain for better conditions, better pay, better wages at work.
Right. Listeners on the show are often asking about how protected their activities with respect to their employers and their conversations about their employers might be under the First Amendment. And we frequently and sadly have to tell them, well, unless you're a government employee, there's really not much there for you. But yeah, here is, you know, the government riding to the rescue on another front. Jack, any thoughts on this?
Well, I think Eric is really, I don't have too much more to add. I think Eric's got a great grasp on it. You know, and the thing is that what I would like to know is if you know, in our society, it's generally at will employment, meaning you don't have to have a particular reason to fire someone as long as you're not doing so because of race, national origin, gender, or something like that. Collective bargaining agreements might not be the same, and they have particular guarantees, as Eric pointed out. So, you know, I would love to see a similar rule like that. But, you know, I think generally we have a pretty tech-savvy listener base or viewer base on the show. But, you know, if you don't, you really have to remember that what you say on Facebook, even if it's to a closed group of people, isn't exactly the same as saying it to a room full of people that are with you. It stays up there. You really can't control very well who can see it. And that's a very different thing about today's world than it was from 10 years ago.
Evan, I don't know about you, but I see a lot of people in the business world who want to talk about their blogging policies, either having one or putting one in place, and it's a misnomer to call it a blogging policy because it needs to and often does cover so much other activity. And mostly what I see, thankfully, are businesses wanting to be very savvy about this and have parameters in place that make sense for them and aren't too draconian. Are you seeing the same kind of thing? Or are you seeing a lot of knee-jerk reaction against people being able to communicate online?
I'm glad you're asking it in this way, because so much of the commentary that's come out on this decision by the NLRB to file this action has been kind of trumpeting the notion, looking at it from the perspective of the employees, like, oh, look, there is this apparent greater freedom for you to go out and say what you want, on these social media platforms. And there's been relatively little attention focused on the interest of management or the employer in how to navigate these waters that were already punctuated by, rough white water to begin with. It really presents a special challenge for employers to do, as you suggest, appear savvy and to maintain all of the things that they want to maintain, like good employee morale, letting them, you know, have a certain, letting employees have a certain sense of independence at work, being able to check into Facebook once in a while, and do those things, while at the same time, having the ability to control the message from a public relations standpoint as well. So this, you know, if there's this risk to management, that the scope of those things that is, you know, for lack of a better term, and I use this term more generally than what the real legal term of art is, if the scope of protected speech is broader than what we originally thought it might have been, that makes this question so much more difficult. So as far as you know, situations that I've been involved with, looking at things, there's a whole whether there are, we are seeing knee-jerk reactions from employers, or whether there's this trend toward, you know, savviness and liberality, so to speak, on all of this. It of course covers the spectrum. A lot of it depends on the nature of the industry that the employer is involved with. You know, a healthcare company or a healthcare organization that employs nurses and physicians and other types of employees who really have a fiduciary relationship with the organization's clientele has a very different sensibility about this than what any other kind of organization that can deal with its clientele on a much more informal basis. So, you know, the smart companies are going to take those considerations into play, you know, how they really need to the extent they truly do need to control the message and manage content employees are saying on social media platforms, both in terms of productivity and public relations. And, you know, there's a certain amount of wisdom that hopefully will pervade through all of these analyses that keeps that realistic marketplace context in the forefront of their decision-making processes.
Right. Well, you know, guys, I have so many stories I would love to just sit here and chat with you about all afternoon. We have a bunch in our links that we haven't gotten to yet, but we are getting down to the end of our allotted time and how long we can expect people to actually stick around and listen to us bloviating away here. So I hate to start to wind it down, but I think I need to because you guys have been so smart and had such great insights on all this stuff. I'm going to give our tip of the week, which actually has a bit of a legal flavor to it, so at least has us be able to continue our discussion along those lines. Tip of the week is kind of a two-prong tip about the new Xbox Kinect game system. First of all, the thing has already been cracked. There's a post over on Engadget. I'm sure Gizmodo has more about someone who has done an end run around whatever blocking technology there is that keeps this thing operating only within certain parameters. There's actually a contest that is out there that has a $3,000 bounty right now to be able to put the Kinect under somebody's control other than Microsoft's. And you could see immediately why that would be a useful thing to do. It's such a, you know, thinking about this as a gaming utility is really kind of limited. There's a lot this device could do with its ability to see people moving through space and respond to that. So the tip is that it's been cracked and open source drivers are on the way for the thing. And also my second tip is a personal one, having used it. It's an incredible video conferencing system. When I first looked at the thing, it reminded me so much of the very sophisticated bits of technology we had in my former law firm, huge multinational law firm, where we would connect up the offices and have 40 people at a time talk to each other. And, its conferencing is really incredible. So if you have not, if you have one and you haven't used that feature, it's called Video Kinect. It's definitely worth looking at. And, the legal twist to all of this, of course, is that it's not technically legal to hack your Kinect, but following in the footsteps of great Xbox hackers in the past, it's been done. And it's not technically legal to use the Kinect for commercial video conferencing. You're bound in by the terms of service of Xbox Live, which says that Microsoft has to approve, specifically allow any commercial uses, and they haven't gone ahead and done that anywhere in the terms. So just tossing that out to the universe of our panel here. Jack, do you see that any of these restrictions on use of this new technology will really slow down what people want to do with it?
No, but I think that if Microsoft is smart, they'll try to embrace and make the functionality available that that this hacker has already is already shown. You know, so they were able to show the feeds from the cameras. They were able to show the different cameras were interacting with each other a little bit. I think it's great. I would encourage Microsoft to embrace it and try not to fight it. We'll see if that works. You know, there are some exceptions to the rules that restrict you from taking from cracking things like the Kinect. There is a reverse engineering exception, but it's very, very limited. And so your diagnosis is probably right that it probably wasn't technically legal for that individual to hack it the way that he did. But at the same time,
I was thinking about the recent exemptions that were issued by the Copyright Office for the DMCA, and you know, for example, making a cell phone, you're able to crack your iPhone and make it be jailbroken and interoperate with other carriers. So, I mean, that's sort of promising along these lines, but I don't know that it would be viewed the same way.
But of course, that was something that, you know, it took almost 2 years for the Copyright Office to decide. It was part of a triennial or every 3 year rulemaking process where the Copyright Office tries to figure out if legitimate uses are being prevented by the restrictions on circumventing technological protection measures like the encryption and stuff that is presumably on the Kinect. Right. And so the Copyright Office said it's perfectly legal to make your phone interoperable with another type of network or another phone. And so and as a result, it's OK to jailbreak your iPhone. So that, unfortunately, doesn't extend to video game consoles. It's strictly limited to phones. And so that, you know, that could be something that someone would ask for and potentially receive, but not until the 2012, which is when the next exemptions are going to be announced. And the fight for those exemptions is only a year away. It's going to start probably in about late 2011. So,
right. Of course, one of the first things I thought when I started playing with the thing is this would be a great way for us to do shows on Twit. You know, if you could have a reliable enough network and if it were legally a viable thing to do. Eric, you were going to chime in.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I hope that maybe Jack and his students will get the Library of Congress to grant an exemption in the DMCA next time around for breaking encryption in order for the object of the survival of the human race. Because I don't know if you've seen this thing, but it is creepy. It is wildly creepy. If you haven't seen it, it goes up and down, follows you around the room, focuses in on you. Watching it, I just can't help but think that Skynet is about to be activated.
Right.
It's, to me, terrifically frightening. Very cool in a way, but wow, creepy.
Yeah. So Burke has a video queued up, I think, that can show us how it was cracked and a bit about that. Let's take a look at it. You can see here, what they've been able to do is make it move up and down. It looks like Johnny Five from one of my favorite old movies.
Just because Johnny Five turned out to be nice, you know, was in large part because of the very humanitarian influence of Ali Sheedy's character. I mean, if there's no one in the life of the Kinect like that, it may turn to evil.
Right. And in other videos you can see over at the Engadget site, you can see that you can get control of the camera and see what it's seeing when it looks at you, et cetera. So it's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure, are we going to get Kit here or are we going to get Christine? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
Who knows? We'll see. Evan, does any of this, the fact that Microsoft is, One of the things that's interesting is it takes their default name that they ship you with the Kinect takes pictures of while you are playing it. You have to turn that off. The default is to leave that on. So the first time you play the game, you're going along and boop, it's photographing you. And of course, you can delete those and you can choose to share them. They're not automatically shared or gathered or presumably sent back to Microsoft. But, you know, Xbox Live is a networked service and they could be collecting some pretty interesting photographic data from users. Does this cause you a concern at all?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, it reminds me of the Lower Merion School District case, which I guess just recently settled, you know, with the student-issued laptops. It's a little bit different with the Borg doing that, you know, versus a school district. So, yeah, I mean, that's something that could be pretty unsettling. But I guess, you know, with all of this innovation and all this stuff, I'm not worried about anything as long as Ed Felton is in charge, you know, as the CTO at the FTC. We should be all right.
Knock wood. Eric, I'm going to let you tell us about our two resources of the week, which are going to be projects that you have worked on. First, tell us about CopySquare.
Well, CopySquare is something that is in development. It's a licensing scheme that is in some ways similar to Creative Commons, if you're familiar with that. But it has three particular requirements in it. One is, and it's supposed to be particularly adapted to media work parts, things like sound effects, B-roll footage, things that document small filmmakers, documentary filmmakers, people who aren't part of the Hollywood establishment might want to use in their films. And one thing that can be a deterrent for using some of the open source or Creative Commons licensed content for that is that if it's licensed under what's called a share-alike type of license, if you use the content, then you have to share the resulting content with everyone else. And if you just want to use some B-roll footage, you might not feel like sharing your whole movie with everyone else. So the three requirements in the CopySquare license are a right to reject, notification so that the person learns about the usage, something they can put on their resume or at least get the satisfaction of knowing about it, and favored nations treatment, which is a way of saying you don't have to pay me, but if you pay other people, then you have to pay me as much and on as good terms. And that kind of borrows an old standby from Hollywood contract practice, the favored nations term. So that's CopySquare, and that's something that's sort of in a long-term development for me, and it's a license project that's going to take a while to work out the details. KonoMark is the other one, and that is something that you can use right now. All KonoMark is just a symbol that says, my content, I'm generally amenable to sharing it with people for free without charging them any money. Just ask me first. So it's not a commitment. You're not making a commitment to share it, but you're just saying, hey, I welcome you asking me to use it. So I've uploaded more than 5,000 photographs to Flickr. You can find them by searching for KonoMark, KonoMark, and some other word that might describe what you want. And I get one or two requests a week asking if people can use a photo for something, and it's kind of fun because you get the satisfaction of knowing that someone was able to use something. So you can both look for KonoMark content to use, and you can KonoMark your own content. You can find out about that at KonoMark.org.
Wonderful! Thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on those. And thank you so much for joining us on the show, Eric. You have some really interesting blogs we should let people know about. Tell folks where they can read more of your writing.
Bloglawblog.com is my blog about the law of blogs. And I post every weekday on that. Pixelization.org is a blog that I have about general intellectual property, entertainment, technology matters. And then I have a kind of my smart alecky humor blog, backbencher.org, where I post my
smart alecky humor.
Very dry humor, yeah, just as long as you understand it. It's the fact that the Constitution's not very well written, things like that.
Well, great. And folks can follow you on Twitter as well, Eric_E_Johnson. to keep up with you there. So thanks so much for joining us on the show. I hope you'll come back again soon.
Oh, it's been a blast, Denise. Thank you.
My pleasure. And Jack, also wonderful to meet you here on the show and to have you join us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jack, too, is on Twitter and has lots of good stuff about his forthcoming panel at South by Southwest and all the other things he's interested in. He is Jack Lerner on Twitter. Anything else you want to let people know about before we sign off here?
No, I think you can find out what I'm up to on Twitter. You can also, you know, mostly what I do is point to or comment on interesting things that are going on. You can find out more about my clinic as well by going to uscIPTLC.org, which stands for USC IP and Technology Law Clinic.org. And the clinic is a part of the USC Law School where I teach, and the students practice law under my supervision, everything from working with policymakers in the developing world to working with local filmmakers and entrepreneurs with IP problems. And one thing we did was we got a DMCA exemption for filmmakers, and we also we filed the FCC comment, and it's a lot of fun and a lot of work. But of course,
your school, University of Southern California, has a famously great film school. So what a wonderful fit that you're able to work with them. Fabulous. Well, it's been really wonderful. I hope you'll join us again soon. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and extend an invitation to both of you, Jack and Eric. If you have openings either next Friday or next Monday, we're doing more shows. So let me know offline if you want to once again delve into these kinds of issues and maybe get to some of the links we missed today.
If you don't mind all of your viewers falling asleep again, that's fine. I mean, you know, Friday's a good nap day, so.
Yeah, I mean, if the chat room's any indication, I don't think we we need to worry about that. Evan, great to have you back, of course.
Great to be back, as usual. Fun time. Nice to meet you, Jack and Eric.
Nice to meet you, too, Evan.
Folks can find Evan, of course, at internetcases.com, and he is internetcases on Twitter, where mostly he's been tweeting about Hooters lately.
That's right. I mean, it's all in the name of science. You know, I just, I started my own URL, installed my little own URL shortener, and just noticed that most of the click-throughs are when you talk about Hooters. So that's the secret to traffic and eyeballs. Just talk about Hooters.
Hey. And if that's not a great tip of the week, I don't know what is.
Right. So, all you need to know.
Yes. Thank you so much, Evan. Of course, we love to hear from all of you. I always post the videos of the show once they're available on YouTube. I also put them over on my blog, bagandbaggage.com. And there are open comments there. So we love to have people chime in. I'd love to hear from you and get your feedback on the show there. You can, of course, always email me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. I am at D Howell on Twitter, where you can find me during the week putting up things that we're going to endeavor to talk about on the show and also discussing how little girls think my hair smells like their grandmother's. And you can, of course, chime in, too, on our Facebook page. We put pre-show questions up there at facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. We record every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, 1 Central, 2 Eastern, 1800 UTC, Fridays live on live.twit.tv. And you can look at our discussion points before the show, during the show, after the show at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/the episode number. So wonderful to convene with you all again this week, and we'll see you next time on Twit.